This is the Loaf Podcast. Welcome back to the bakery, everyone, where we break bread with the world's finest. Today, we're very lucky to be here with Dr. Paul Conti, a renowned psychiatrist, author of Trauma, the Invisible Epidemic, and the man who saved Lady Gaga's life. Dr. Conti, thank you so much for being here with us today.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you, and thank you for the kind introduction. I appreciate it.
Of course, it's only the truth. So just to begin, the first thing that kind of really struck me reading your book is that trauma is often seen as something that happens in the past. It's an event, but actually what you come to make me understand is that it fundamentally alters our brain functioning and our perception of reality from that point on. People often say there's a world before and after. So could you just unpack how exactly that functions in the brain and the kind of ways it can change people looking at the world?
Sure. I think the first thing we need to do is define trauma, right? Because it's a common word, so it can mean so many things to so many people. The definition of trauma that I'm talking about is something negative that impacts us, and it could be acute, it could be chronic over time, it could even be vicarious, but it rises to the level of overwhelming our coping skills. And then on the other side of that, our brains are different. And when our brains are changed, they behave differently. So for example, if a neutral stimulus comes to us, like a new face, for example, instead of seeing it in a neutral light and assessing from there, we may have an automatic negativity. There are many things that change inside of us, including physical functioning. So functioning of our immune system, for example, can change and predispose us to illnesses. So if the trauma rises to the level of actually changing how our brain functions, then it affects everything in us, physically, mentally, emotionally, behavioral choices. And that's the definition of trauma that I'm choosing because, one, it's a science-based definition, and two, it lets us look at the downstream effects of trauma, which, of course, hopefully leads us to both prevention and even more importantly, of course, treatment and even more importantly, prevention.
Yeah. And I mean, speaking of trauma, I wanted to touch on something which is obviously quite personal to you. You've shared in your book and in other places a deeply personal story about your brother's tragic death. Yes. And I was wondering how this personal experience with grief and tragedy shaped and developed your own understanding of trauma, maybe beyond purely scientific data.
Sure. Well, at the time that happened, you know, I hadn't gone to medical school. I mean, I graduated from college, but I was in a business career. I mean, I wasn't prepared to understand. Nowhere in my background had I been taught how such a tragedy impacts us. So I could see, of course, that I was supposed to be sad and I felt sad, but there was so much more than that. You know, I felt guilty. I felt ashamed. I felt like the world was a different place. My whole self-conception from someone who could work hard and achieve and, you know, make a good life for myself really changed. And my judgment and all sorts of decisions changed. And what I was coming to understand was a whole self shift away from things that were more often than not, you know, good and healthy and productive towards a different way of seeing life that was beleaguered and angry and afraid and confused. And I could see that it was driving my life to places that like weren't going to be okay. You know, so that led me to get some help from supportive people around me and ultimately get some treatment. But that was a big stretch. I mean, it wasn't well understood or accepted to get mental health help. So I had to get myself to a place of realizing, hey, this is out here to be had. I don't need to be ashamed of needing help and getting help. And really something just must change in me or I'm in real trouble.
Mm. You talk about trauma being the invisible epidemic. And yet you're talking about a time further back when even more so, it was unacceptable or considered not normal to do this kind of thing and seek help. Do you see a general positive trend? And what are the changes do you see in the way people are talking about and dealing with trauma and mental health more generally?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we've come very far in this period of time, which is over a quarter century of time. But I don't think that it's more accepted to get mental health, at least not in most parts of the United States. I've had the good fortune of living in England at one period of time, which was a wonderful experience. But I don't know. I haven't spent much time there now. I don't know how it may have changed, but there are very low levels of resource availability, I think, in both countries and, of course, in many, many others, too. So the resources are less available. The social situation does not predispose us to understanding, okay, here's what's going on with me. I should get help. It's not like one's knee hurting, right? If your knee hurts and it keeps hurting, like there's something to do about that. There's a certain kind of doctor to see. It's not a shame. It's not shameful to go do that. But not a lot has changed. And despite the opiate epidemic, certainly in the United States and the many, many, there's countless, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of deaths and the tribulations during the pandemic, we have not done a better job of helping our society understand what trauma is, how it changes us, and how we can get help. It's still often seen to be soft or esoteric. An example I give in it is that trauma, in the way that I'm describing, the way that makes brain changes, makes us older than our age. So a person can be 20 years old or 30 or 50 by the calendar, but actually inside of them, how quickly our cells age, how quickly we move towards death, we can actually be older than our age. So I don't know if there's a better hard science concept to show that this is valid. And it hurts us throughout life, and it can foreshorten our lives. So I don't think we've understood or appreciated that on a broad level any more than we did a few decades ago.
Ever shown up to the beach with a big bush, getting rejected left, right, and center, so you have to walk away with your pubes between your legs? Then get yourself a Manscaped and rule the beach. Wear your shorts with no shame. Get the Performance Package 5.0 Ultra now with a discount code LOAF to get a full 20% off so that your baguette leaves no crumbs.
Yeah, it's quite interesting how you speak about trauma being passed on. And the way I've understood it, at least from what you say, is that it can work on a genetic level, but it also can be social. And I was wondering what you had to say about intergenerational trauma. So, for example, the trauma of the Jewish people and the Holocaust kind of gets passed on to even people nowadays. How does this work? What's the mechanism? Is it more social or is it also quite genetic?
In the last quarter century, a field of scientific and medical endeavor called epigenetics has been really created and risen to the forefront. We've had the scientific capability now of understanding that things that happen to us can change how our genes are passed along. And it can seem as if the genetic transmission is different. So you still may get a gene, but the gene may be no longer active. So there are changes then in genetic transmission, which was really unheard of before. I mean, this was thought, this is not a thing. This does not happen to us. You know, it's not that experiences actually change our genetic profile, even at the time that even at the time of conception or the time of birth. And we've come to understand this in ways that are so informative. So one example is, you know, we would see that children, for example, of Holocaust survivors had higher levels of anxiety and a higher likelihood to isolate and to not feel a sense of comfort in the world, which was thought to come through the way that children were raised, that they were going to be then, they were raised by people who had been through such terrible experiences that they were more cautious and that they were going to lead a child to have a sort of view of the world that was more anxious. And what we see now is that can indeed be true, but the actual genes are changed. So even if you imagine a child of Holocaust survivors who is conceived but then raised in a way that no one even knew about this, so raised separate from the parents, that child has a much greater likelihood of being anxious and avoidant, even though the child may not even know the parents, right? Because the genes that are passed on are changed. And this is of incredible importance. You know, a colleague of mine named Darren Richarder, who does a lot of work and with the World Court, really has been at the forefront of this, of recharacterizing. So, for example, traumas that are perpetuated during wartime have been seen mostly through a criminal lens. Like, okay, someone did something that was wrong, and then it's looked at through a criminal and legal lens. But now that the conception has shifted to say that trauma can affect that person not only for the rest of their lives, but it can affect their children, even if their children aren't born until years later, and it can affect their children's children. So we see the tremendous toll of trauma, not just on the current generation, but generations forward. And if the things we've just been talking about in the last several minutes are not enough to get us to say, hey, we need to look at this. We need to pay attention to us. What burdens of misery are we creating and passing along? I mean, I don't know what's going to get us there if this doesn't get us there.
There's this link between mental and physical health. And I sense this stigma around speaking around mental health that just doesn't exist with physical health. So, for example, my great-grandmother had diabetes and then I have it. There isn't so much stigma around me inheriting that. But if we speak in the same way about anxiety, I feel like there's this need to always temper it with, going to a psychologist always a little bit more quiet. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Sure. We have a tremendous stigma around mental health. And I think that is because it's not understood that, you know, mental health is an aspect of brain health. Now, psychiatry is really a subdiscipline of neurology. We just call it neurology if we can understand the science a bit better. If we say, oh, we can see where that is on MRI, or we can use an EEG and check those brain waves and see that why that person is having seizures. You know, things that we can see or understand better, we tend to call neurology. Things that we don't understand, we tend to call psychiatry or psychology. And then it seems like they're not rooted in our physical health. So it just comes from us in a way that, something that is sort of less than about us, you know, would come like, oh, that person is more anxious, or what's wrong with them, as opposed to there's something going on in the brain. And it's all physical health in the sense that from head to toe, this is what we're talking about. If it's brain function, no, that's still part of us. And it's part of us that affects the rest of us. So, for example, autoimmune illnesses, cardiovascular illnesses, so heart disease, risk of strokes, these are all so much more highly present when there is trauma. So we know that heart disease, strokes, autoimmune diseases, these all run so high after trauma. So it's not only all intermingled, but our mental health is actually in many, many ways deterministic of our physical health.
Drawing on that is something that Ollie and I have spoken quite a lot about before this interview, and that's the the way in which you might reconcile the neurological perspective, which might be seen more deterministic, with the idea of agency that you're so keen on and the ability to shape one's own path. How would you respond to this seeming contradiction?
See, being trained as a psychiatrist and having some neurology training as well, you know, the board is in the United States is the board of psychiatry and neurology, right? It also comes together. So then that doesn't seem so surprising to me. Like there are ways of understanding, for example, how our brains work when we become more or less comfortable in the world. What changes inside of us if we become more anxious, if we make decisions to say not try new things, not try for a better job, or not smile back at the person who smiles at us if someone is interested in a relationship or in a friendship. You know, the changes in us are brain-based. So I think of the areas of the brain that start functioning differently, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, the anterior cingulate gyrus. Like these are names of places in the brain, but how these places function determine, like, how do I feel today? Am I in good spirits? Am I looking forward to the day? Do I feel like I can do my job well? Or am I anxious? Am I worried about what's going to happen next? Do I not feel up to the task? These are huge differences in us, and they can be understood in the same way. We might assess, oh, is that person having seizures? Well, we think they might be, but what are the behaviors that show us that? What parts of the brain might be involved? How can we understand it? It's all the same thing. It's just that we are still living in the stigma of mental health and in the idea that it's esoteric, like it's some nebulous hand waving, or it's soft, it's not hard science, and that we don't really know what to do about it anyway. So no, people should just try to be less anxious, right? I mean, we would not say this if we knew someone has a huge risk of a heart attack, and what are we going to do, and what medicines would we bring to bear? We wouldn't say, oh, they should just go home and try not to have a heart attack, right? But we don't understand that it's science, that it's in us, that it's part of us, and that our mental health affects us more than any other aspect of our health. So if you think about this, at least 50%, and almost surely far more, of the complaints that people bring to physical medicine physicians, so all doctors who aren't psychiatrists, right? The complaints that go to physicians, more than half come from mental health. So if you think about it, it's not that that person, their stomach problems, their chest tightness, their dizziness, right? And even if they have a rash, right? But the rash is coming from stress and anxiety. More than half of what we complain about in our bodies comes from our brains. So these are very clear and obvious markers saying, hey, let's pay attention to this. It can determine not only if I'm happy today, right, or if I feel good about myself today, but if I'm sick or healthy today.
Thank you. Yeah. I think the question for me, something that learning more about mental health really taught me, is to be significantly more forgiving with people about the way they act because of the understanding of where it comes from. But then to build on the agency thing, I wonder where you think and how far it comes in. Responsibility, because just to give a personal example, when I was younger, I had a friend who had quite a traumatic childhood, and as a result, acted out in certain ways with drinking, with behavior towards his friends and such forth. And we all stuck by him for a long time and eventually made the decision that we could no longer be friends with him effectively because of sort of these repeated cycles of behaviors. And I was wondering where you think responsibility should come in from the individual person's perspective. When it is trauma that's causing it, and yet nonetheless, there's sort of a cycle of events occurring, if that makes sense.
Sure. We absolutely have responsibility for ourselves. I believe that as a society, we could, would, should shoulder greater responsibility for each other, non-destruction coming first, perhaps. But yes, despite what society may or may not be doing for us, we have responsibility for ourselves. So if we are not doing well, functioning well, if a person thinks, you know, I'm drinking too much and I'm not really being a friend to my friends, and actually I don't feel very good physically, I'm out of shape, I don't have much energy, and maybe that makes me more irritable and more likely to make decisions that aren't healthy for me and for other people, we have responsibility to look at ourselves and to think about that. I mean, the law holds us responsibility, you know, legally, our medical legal traditions, you know, tell us how we're responsible for ourselves. The idea that, well, I'm not responsible for that because I was drunk is not an answer. It's like, well, you should have thought, you know, before getting drunk, or thought about where and how much to get drunk. We bear responsibility for ourselves. And, you know, society certainly doesn't help us by perpetuating stigma and conceptions of how we work, how we function, that are not accurate. What can lead us forward is compassionate curiosity, that for us to be compassionate about ourselves and others, which doesn't mean that we're not saying, hey, I bear responsibility for myself and you do for you. I mean, compassion isn't saying, oh, let's let anything go, right? It's a process of inquiry that can let us then think, you know, what is going on with me? When might it have started? How is it getting worse? What might I do about it? What are other people around me noticing? This is how we get to the point of agency and gratitude, the places that we truly want to be. And there are ways to do this. You know, in September, I released a series of four podcasts with the Huberman Lab platform, and they've done extremely well. And one reason they've done so well is they present, like, here's how we can think about ourselves. It's not as if, you know, our mental health is a black box. but boy, like, we understand the knee, so we can get an x-ray and we can look at it, or we can do physical therapy, or we can operate. The same principles are true of our mental health, that we can understand how we work. We can have a route of inquiry in front of us that helps us take compassionate curiosity and make of it understanding and change. But we have to know to do that. And since society, and certainly medicine, is not doing a good job of letting us know this, the idea was to put it all out there so that we can access it ourselves, and it can help us take responsibility for ourselves.
I think it's like you say about being open. The first step is really gaining that awareness of asking yourself those questions. Why am I drinking? Why am I acting like this towards my friends? Why do I want to be like this? Something that might hinder that, and which I relate to feeling, is your concept of blinders in your book, which is the idea that trauma puts up walls within your brain and shuts certain things out for certain reasons, as a comfort, maybe as a decision-making mechanism. So for somebody who's looking to take the blinders off and start to be truthful with themselves about their trauma, about why they might be acting the way they are, what can we do to begin to open up our own mind and speak to ourselves?
So one thing that anyone can do, and it doesn't require even insurance, it doesn't cost money, doesn't even have to require other people, though it can, is the process of a life narrative. You know, we don't know what we've missed. As you said, we can't look on the other side of the blinders if we don't know that they are there. And thinking about our lives, constructing a life narrative, it may seem very simple, but so many of us don't do this. And we might say, well, my life narrative is I was born here and I was raised there, and then I went this place or that place. No, I mean a real life narrative of how we feel about ourselves. And the story I most commonly tell, because I think it's so striking, is of a young woman who won an award in high school. And it was an award that said, hey, you're smart and you're capable. And it was very, very encouraging, right? And it gave her a set of thoughts that felt good about herself, that she can go make something of herself in the world, and that there was some faith and confidence in her. And even though she didn't come from a place that gave her a lot of advantages, she saw the award as really an endorsement of her. And then after having been through some very significant traumas, and it wasn't even many years down the later, but a few years down the road, she saw that in a very, very different light. And if you asked her about it, she would talk about it as if it were an insult and a mockery, that here was this award given to someone who can't make anything of herself, you know, almost to say, well, this is the best you're ever going to do. Right. And she saw it in a way that was tinged with bitterness, and it was very depressive, and really had hopelessness flowing through it. And she didn't realize, did not understand, did not remember that she had thought of the award differently. Now, if this can happen in such a clear way, something so important in someone's life, and not that many years from the feelings and thoughts they had about it, no, what else is happening in us, in so many of us, where we lose the thread of our own lives? And if we write a life narrative, what were things like when I was younger? Who were the people in my life? How did I feel? How was I treated? What did I do? Where did I go? You know, when might things have changed inside of me? And people around us can help. If we've written diaries, for example, that can help us. Or people who know us well can help us. And it's from the perspective of a life narrative that we can really sort of put the rubber to the road of that curiosity within us. And a realization may happen, for example, that, well, you know, after college, I got that first job and, you know, things kind of changed. You know, I wasn't out in the world. I wasn't meeting as many people. And, you know, I started to think of myself differently, and I wasn't really dating. And, you know, sometimes a person can realize, oh, things really changed. What might have happened? Now, maybe it was an acute trauma, like the death of a loved one, an injury, an accident. Oh, wow, things were really different after that. But sometimes it's not that. It might be, for example, the chronic trauma of discrimination, right? Of discrimination because of reasons like race, sexuality, socioeconomic status, you know, many, many, many possibilities that then can add up, can inculcate and accumulate in a person and lead to different feelings. So if we don't have compassionate curiosity and we don't explore, which can again be ourselves, with people around us, by reading, by meditating, by going to therapy, right? Then we're not going to learn about ourselves. And it's the learning about ourselves that empowers change. And there is a scientific process to this. And again, I've referenced this before, but the Huberman Lab podcast really set out, like, there is a way to do this. It's not just go, and see what comes to you, but there are ways of understanding ourselves that we can use to learn. And I keep anchoring all the time to change, that this isn't esoteric. It's not pie in the sky. You know, I have a clinic with 30 something people here, and we are in the business of empowerment. I mean, we're based in New York and in Portland, Oregon. People who come to see us come to Portland, Oregon, and we do intensive work individually and with couples that does this, that opens up the compassionate curiosity, brings professionals to bear, helps people create a life narrative and a pathway, not just to, oh, how have I gotten here? But if you can see how you've gotten here, then you can make the map, right, of where you're going from here. So I want to emphasize that it's very practical. And, you know, this business of empowerment, you know, we can do a lot of it on our own. And I try and set forth in the book and in podcasts, including podcasts like this, how we can do that.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. And I listened to your podcast with Chris Williamson, and he speaks about this as well, the idea of the stories that we tell ourselves, right? Yes. And I also, you also talk about this this idea that really flourished in English modernism. And for those that are listening, there's this writer, Ford Madox Ford, yes, who you've talked about, Dr. Conti, and he says that he gives this metaphor of a goodly apple. And
goodly
and
apple. Person, I've told the goodly apple story before. Part of the benefit, I'm sorry to interrupt, but my education in England was I learned about Ford Madox Ford. I learned a lot about English modernism. And I actually tell the goodly apple story. So, but I'd like you to tell it. I want to listen to it because I've not heard someone else tell it before. But I think what you are saying is really at the heart of what I'm speaking to. And I think a lot of that was brought to bear and understood and written about by English modernist writers. So yeah, I get excited, but please talk about the goodly apple, please.
No, absolutely. Because I study English here at Oxford. So English is my degree. And we've spoken with kind of Simon Critchley, who also likes to read philosophy and life through the lens of fiction. Yes. So I think there's an interesting kind of conglomeration between psychology, philosophy, literature, and Ford Madox Ford, for those listening, speaks about this goodly apple, which a person really enjoys while they're eating it. And when they finish it, there's a worm in the middle of the apple. And the question is, was the apple a good apple? Was the experience of eating it, is it changed because of the conclusion? And this is also, you know, brought to bear by Virginia Woolf, who talks about time and temporality and the ways in which our own understanding of our past is changed through our current and future experiences. And my question in that vein was about the ways in which someone can tell their own story, right, to themselves and understand their own past after trauma. Is the goal to kind of look at, reflect on one's own past life and reshape it, or is it rather finding some underlying truth? Is it kind of this more postmodernist perspective of shaping one's own meaning, or is there something at the bottom which we need to reach?
Well, I think if we shape meaning, which to me means if we understand, right? If we can understand, then sometimes we will recharacterize, right? So someone who has had running through their mind, like, oh, I'm a loser. No one will love me. No one will care about me. You know, may shift that to there's nothing wrong with me, but some of the circumstances I was raised in were not okay, right? There were people who are not okay, people who are not healthy, who then led me to feel a certain way. And it's not that I'm incapable, right? The problem or the shame isn't with me, it's with others, right? So it can lead to a change in conception. But the key to all of it is is the conception we have in the present and where it leads us in the future. And I think, Lucas, there must be a lot of commonality between us, because when I talk about Ford Madox Ford, I do often segue into talking about Virginia Woolf. And I think the passage of time, you know, how it's not just linear inside of us, where in the waves or to the lighthouse, you know, you'll see that something very small in the context of what one might think of an event from the outside, something small or minor, you know, is a chapter of richness inside the person. And then a bunch of years pass, you know, rapidly. So our perception of time is so strongly dictated by the emotion within us. And I think, to me, that's the biggest lesson of English modernism, is how emotion impacts us. It can make time last very, very long, where that 2 minutes, you know, might be months and months of your life in terms of the brain space it takes up inside and the impact of it. Then there can be months where we don't carry very much forward with us. And I write in the book that I wrote about this, because we don't, you know, we don't see it this way. So we don't understand that our memories are only brought alive by emotion. Otherwise, our memories are just flat. Like, imagine they're styrofoam. There's nothing really to them, but they go out and they get like an emotion flag. And it tells us, what is the meaning of that memory? So you could say car accident, that, you know, that doesn't mean anything unless a person maps that to something. Like, it does that map to fear because it's, I was hurt? Does it map to a sense of bravery because someone else was in an accident and I helped them? Right. So it's emotion that gives everything inside of us life. And if we understand, we think more about how it impacts us, how we feel about things. And this is what brings us again back around to trauma, making a reflexive sense of guilt and sense of shame. And this can be so very powerfully with us that we have to be curious about ourselves. Time is not linear, as you're pointing out. Emotion has a tremendous effect and impacts how we see ourselves in the passage of time. So we have to look at ourselves through this lens of interest and curiosity. What are the stories that we tell ourselves? What is our self-talk? You know, I tell another story about a person who was very, very much underperforming in life. If you saw how intelligent this person was, and they had a really excellent educational pedigree, and they had a very, very a tedious job that was very low paying, a job that I don't know that even required a college education. This person had a prestigious master's degree. And as I was trying to figure this out, you know, what is going on here? The person was driving far to get to that job. And I thought, wait a second, there are jobs like that closer. Like, it just kind of made me curious. And I asked the question, the person really liked music. And I thought, maybe they're listening to music in the car. And I learned that the person was taking the long drive with the radio off so that they could just tell themselves over and over again, oh, you're a loser. You know, you'll never get anywhere. You should be ashamed of yourself, right? And you know, when you think about that, the cycle that person was stuck in of feeling badly about themselves, and this was for reasons that were so clearly based in trauma and trauma that was minimized. You know, the person didn't understand how much the trauma had been internalized and made the person feel unsafe and inadequate. And then coming from that was anger and frustration with the self and the idea of, oh, you're a loser. He was so mad at himself. And, you know, I see signs around sometimes that say the beatings will not stop until morale improves, right? Which is like a not so funny joke, right? Because that's what goes on in so many of us. So this person was just beating himself down while believing that life should just get better. And what needed to change was an understanding of that. What's the life narrative that led to that? What was the impact of saying that? How many hundreds of times on the way to work and back and in the shower and while making dinner? All of that had to change. And that person's life is entirely different. You can look at that person's achievement now and go, oh, it's achievement commensurate with the intelligence and the diligence of that person, but that was not going to happen without generating an understanding of self, including what am I saying to myself? What does it mean? Even apprehending, oh my goodness, I'm driving all of this way and I'm doing it in order to torment myself. Like somehow I think my life is going to get better, right? So it's just so important. And when we do this, again, the message I keep bringing is, we can do this and it can create change, but it's not going to come to us automatically. It's just not how we work. And the society around us keeps telling us the same stereotypes over and over and over again. And, you know, does not help us to look into ourselves.
Mm-hmm. This story of the patient who was driving just to tell themselves that they were worthless, et cetera, I guess, is a perfect example of why you call shame one of the major accomplices to trauma. But I wanted to ask you why you think shame is the one that particularly sticks around. When we feel happy, for example, it's a fleeting thing, or when we feel fulfilled, it's fleeting, and yet somehow people can get caught in a cycle of shame for a very long time. Why do you think that is, and why do you think it's so incisive?
Sure. So shame occurs in us as a reflex to trauma. So just like as a physician, I can tap the hammer on someone's knee and the knee comes out. It's a reflex. Shame is a reflex also. A reflexed trauma is ashamed. How many people have I heard who were assaulted with no fault of their own whatsoever? So they're in a place it's okay for them to be, and someone attacks them, someone hits them. They talk about a feeling of what's wrong with them. That they're ashamed they were there. They're ashamed they were dressed the way they were. They're ashamed they were talking to who they were talking. And you think that person would never, never, never say that to another human being, right? Someone who is walking down the street, or it's dusk, they're assaulted, something bad happened to them, to say, oh, you know what? That was your fault, right? But we will say those things to ourselves, right? Because the shame is a reflex inside of us. And then we hide the shame away. So the same way, if there's an infection, you know, in us, we need to open the infection up to the light. We need to put some antibiotic cream on the infection. So if we have an infection on the outside of us and we just hide it away, well, let's just, you know, let's completely cover it up, and we're not going to look at it. We're not going to open it up to the air. What happens is that infection can spread. And this is what goes on inside of us. Why would the shame go away if it festers inside of us and we don't expose it to the light of day, right, to the sunlight of thought and discussion that would essentially fix it, that would make it go away? Why would it go away? It doesn't, right? What it does is it gets worse. And now maybe the shame I feel when I don't feel good enough leads me to act more unhealthily. Maybe I'm drinking more and I'm more irritable with people around me, like things that happened after my own trauma when I was younger. Well, that doesn't go so well. Then, you know, I was spending time with people who maybe weren't the greatest to spend time with, people who had their own issues, weren't wanting to move their lives ahead, maybe weren't looking at themselves any more than I would, than I was at the time. But then negative things happen in life, and then I feel worse about myself. And then I start telling myself, what's wrong with me? And, you know, so this is what happens, and it happens so often. And I've seen it in my own life. And after going to medical school and becoming a psychiatrist, you know, I've seen 20 something years of this happening in people. And what's remarkable is how preventable it is. I mean, again, you're asking a great question, like, why does this come into us and then it stays and it festers and it gets worse? Well, if it's a reflex and then we hide it away from the light of day and then build up all these unhealthy defenses around it, that's why. And that's why we see it en masse in millions of people. And sorry. And I have to say, and their brains are changed. Again, it's not, oh, pull oneself up by one's bootstraps. Like, it's not that. Our traditions in understanding trauma come from combat trauma. Some of that observation in science occurring in the United Kingdom after the wars earlier in the century, people who were shell-shocked, right, of realizing, whoa, like a person is very, very different after the trauma they went through. And we've learned a lot in the last 100 years, but have we really learned a lot in terms of understanding and creating change? Maybe not so much.
You speak about the brain. So the way I'm trying to understand it is also this idea of the micro and the macro. You have an individual trauma, but there's perhaps also this idea of a collective trauma, which we also discussed in relation to the Holocaust. And I wanted to maybe complicate it a little bit and bring up the idea of German collective guilt. As a somewhat half German myself, I've noticed that in my family, and my family wasn't kind of didn't descend from Nazis, but you still notice that there's a shame, and there's the thing that we call the silent generation, this idea of shaming oneself, bringing things, kind of pushing things away. So while we talked about Holocaust survivors having trauma in the sense that they were the victims, you have the perpetrators of the Holocaust, so Germany, and shame and guilt, and in some sense trauma, though from a very different angle, being passed down throughout generations and being very suppressed, in that perhaps the country itself can't heal itself, if you understand what I mean by that.
Yes. So I think you're bringing up something very, very important, this idea of collective guilt and guilt that's passed on, because when you think of when the Holocaust occurred, I don't know what percentage of people, of living Germans now, were alive during that period of time. It's going to be a very, very small percentage of the population. But as you said, the guilt gets passed down, as we see at times in the United States around slavery. We see where the guilt gets passed down. And if it is hidden away, if it is denied, if we make conflict around it with others who do not want to deny it, then we perpetuate it and make it worse. I mean, I am not a great expert on how Germany across the years has handled the Holocaust, but in some of what I have read, and I spent some time in Germany as well, I think that Germany has done an admirable job of facing it, of acknowledging it, of saying this happened here, and we're not trying to hide it. And there are monuments and memorials, and people talk about it. Again, I don't know if it feels that way, you know, being from Germany. And again, I'm just an outsider coming in or reading books or literature, but I have always perceived there to be a greater openness in Germany to acknowledgement than there is, for example, in the United States around slavery or other elements of trauma. And I think then we're opening it up to the light of day of what does it mean that this happened in our nation, right? What were the social forces or the institutional forces? How have we learned from it? Have we learned the lessons of history? And I know, of course, that Germany is one of the most all-inclusive democracies on earth now. And Germany took in Syrian refugees when a lot of other nations didn't. I mean, I think a lot of what has happened is Germany learning in the sense of people wanting to take responsibility and saying, well, whether I was alive then, whether, I'm from a lineage that had some hand in that or didn't, like, what, it doesn't really matter. Those things don't matter. What matters is that I'm here now, right? And I'm here now, and I'm part of this place. I'm a citizen of this place, and I want to learn and understand so that we not only prevent tragedy, but we look outward to make the world a better place. And this could be said of everyone everywhere. Right. I mean, there are collective traumas that come down to people just by being human. And I do think that there are ways Germany sets an example of let's look right at this, because otherwise, how are we going to learn from the lessons of the past? And I'm sure more of that could be done by all of us. But in general, we tend to push down collective trauma. And, you know, in the book that I wrote, Stephanie von Gutenberg, who is a German child advocate, you know, I interview both Darren Richarder, who is a psychiatrist at Stanford, who I referenced previously about the brain science and brain changes and trauma. And I also interview in the book Countess von Gutenberg, because she understands, she's written about, you know, what happens when trauma befalls children, the most vulnerable part of life to set these unhealthy pathways in us. How do we understand it? How do we avoid it? So I think we have to look directly at what is traumatic and what lessons we can learn, whether it's the Holocaust, it's child trafficking in the present, right? It's all the things that the vectors of our species continue to point towards greater destruction, which I think it's hard to argue know, when you see the history in recent times, that we aren't moving towards a destruction that threatens us all, that threatens the survival of the species. And I think we need to look more at the traumas in individuals and in societies that drive unhealthy and destructive behavior, and will drive it unless we look at it and we turn those things into lessons of healing, of health, of prevention.
Yeah, I think you're right that at the base really is the openness to be able to discuss it, because that takes away the shame. And I think one thing that does that really well, and this is going to lead into my question, is religion and the kind of confession that happens in Christianity, for example, or in Islam, the repentance. And this leads me to something interesting, because in your book, I was sort of taken aback to find you mention religion as an important factor in trauma, because usually when somebody puts their scientific hat on, whether they're religious or not, they tend to stop talking about religion. And yet you cite the loss of religion as a major factor in trauma. What do you think religion does for people, and why do you think that has such a significant impact?
Well, you know, it may not be so much the loss of religion as the loss of groundedness to the values of the religion. I think major religious traditions, to the best of my understanding, they speak to compassion. They speak to reflection. They speak to groundedness, to simple, healthy values. You know, good mental health is always consistent with simplicity of concept, even though it can be very hard to get there. And it is remarkable to see how often the tenets, the premises, the heart of major religious traditions are around compassion and acceptance, and, you know, doing unto others as we would wish others to do unto us. I mean, these are common concepts, but they don't get lived out. Like, people may go to a place of worship or to a certain religious belief, and then when you see their behaviors, they are so diametrically opposed. I mean, I think we see that in the United States now in ways that are absolutely shocking, where, you know, people are wearing the sort of mantle of Christianity, right? They're saying, I understand and follow the ways of Christ. And, you know, Christ was compassionate and understanding and accepting and self-sacrificing. And you can see people automatically, like in a moment, transition into prejudice and bigotry and hatefulness and behaviors that one would be ashamed of. You know, their behaviors, our political figures are engaging in, I don't want my 6 and 10-year-old children to see. I mean, they'd get suspended from elementary school, you know, for behaviors anywhere near like that. So it's not how the religions are actualized, the structures of power around religions. It's what do the religions actually say, right? And I think it's that we become divorced from, where someone says, oh, I am A, or I follow, then they'll cite a religious belief, and the thought is, do you? Right? Like, is that really what's going on? Or does it just feel good to say that? Or does it feel safe to say that? Right? Does it feel self-righteous to say that? Is that an excuse for looking at oneself? Because, boy, I hear the declaration of how religious I am in so many ways that seems quite sanctimonious to me, when just a moment later we've transitioned into why I'm better than you, or why I know more than you, or why you're not good enough. And I mean, it's remarkable how that's almost become, I think it's rooted in many ways in shame that leads people to have that reflex, right? But we see it in more and more shameful ways.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I feel in some sense religion can help with certain values, but there is also a sense of divisiveness, as you seem to kind of pick up on. Just a belief in karma, for example, to move away from the monotheistic religions, uh-huh. It might lead one to blame oneself in some way for traumatic events, because it's been passed down. And there's a similar idea in Christianity with original sin. There's a sense of blaming the self. I'm trying to kind of parse out, would you say there's some values that one should take from religion, or is it good to be kind of wholly devoted to a religion? What would you say the best strategy for dealing with, for example, a trauma is? Do you think it's dependent on the person, they're dependent on the kind of own upbringing? What would you say to that?
Well, I think we have to start by anchoring to the premises, right? To the real core premises, whether it's karma or it's the concept of original sin, those concepts don't take away our responsibility for ourselves. I mean, my understanding of original sin is saying, look, we are not perfect. There's the imperfection within us that will lead us to do things, right, that aren't great and that we don't feel proud of. That's not a license to just go and do whatever we choose, right? It's telling us we are supposed to strive for being the best that we can be. We are supposed to strive for better karma, for working against the weight of original sin through compassion and good deeds in the world around us. So let's understand the concepts first. And very, very often, you know, people will cite, you know, huge anchoring concepts like karma or original sin with no understanding of what they mean. You know, the idea is to work towards agency, gratitude, humility, empowerment, right? Towards being the people we want to be in the world around us. And I think if a person doesn't understand that, then they're not part of whatever tradition it may be, typical or atypical, monotheistic or polytheistic. It doesn't matter. If we don't understand the basic principles, and again, you just cited two very big basic principles that are absolutely consistent with responsibility for ourselves, although often how I see them lived is the opposite.
I want to move it on, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
And it's playing on the concept of responsibility to the linking of trauma and substance abuse. And the reason I'm linking it back is because I think often substance abuse is dealt with and thought of as an illness, and in a way the responsibility is kind of taken away. But I know that for me, example, me personally, I've used alcohol in the past in my life to not think about certain issues. And I'm wondering kind of what powers that in people, why there's such a strong synergy between substance abuse and trauma, and where our responsibility lies, again, in a similar way to trauma, to step in and take action ourselves.
Sure, sure. You know, the framing of substance dependence as an illness, with modern brain science, does make sense. So you see, if someone is using alcohol excessively, the brain is changing, right? And then there's a pervasiveness of the pattern, but it does not take away responsibility. So like earlier, diabetes was referenced. Okay, like we clearly understand diabetes is an illness, but that doesn't mean the person is then not responsible for taking care of themselves. In fact, if you have diabetes, you have to take care of yourself in certain ways, right, in order to stay alive, right, let alone to move forward through life healthily. So we can identify illness processes in us, and that is not only not delinked to responsibility, but it is linked to responsibility. Probably all of us should watch our diet and our sugar intake like people do when they have diabetes and they're taking care of their diabetes. We all have that responsibility, but the diabetes pushes to the forefront the responsibility. So I think the same is true with substances. And there's such a strong link between substances and trauma, because substances, as you said, to forget about things, right? Substances, they seduce us into soothing in the moment, right? So seduction is like anything that kind of lures you in like this in a nice way, but there's a hammer behind the back, right? So seduction will say, hey, don't you want to feel better right now? I mean, don't you want to not have social anxiety right now? Don't you want to forget about that thing you want to forget about right now? I mean, there's the alcohol in front of you, right? So in the short term, if we just look at it this way, you know, the substances are making a strong argument, right? But we are responsible for looking beyond that and to say, right, what that really is like is, you know, borrow a dollar or borrow a pound today to pay 20 back tomorrow. Like, that's not a good bargain. If someone says, do you want a pound today? Okay. You want to pay 20 back tomorrow? Now I don't want that anymore, right? So it's our responsibility, and for the societies around us to which we all contribute, to foster seeing ourselves across time, valuing and respecting ourselves enough that we don't accept the appeal of the short-term soothing. You know, as I say, I've said many, many times, you know, I don't think I've never met anyone in about a quarter century of doing this who they are having a problem with drugs and or alcohol. And I ask them why. And they say, you know, life was kind of going okay. And I just thought it might be good to wreck it. I mean, no one says that, right? So how do people come across these problems? You know, sometimes it's not an understanding of genetics. There are genetics for alcohol dependence that say, oh, certain people should stay very, very much away from alcohol. It affects people in different ways and is much more addictive. I mean, there are ways we can become dependent upon substances, but the primary way that I have seen over and over and over again, and anyone who works in the field sees this, is that trauma paves the way to substances, right? And AA, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous, I know it's different. It's AA is the Auto Association, right, in the UK, right?
I wouldn't know that.
I think it was.
It might be.
In the US, it's AAA, AAA for your car, right? AA is Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm just referencing the group of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, you know, very much against substances. You know, there was a period of time when even the people who are in the founding roots of AA were sending people for psychedelic treatment, right? And so think about that. They were sending people for LSD treatment at the time. It was being done in Canada, and many, many people were getting better. They were seeing there were people who were not getting better with regular treatment and going to AA, and they were heading towards, you know, towards their life being destroyed or heading towards death. And they were referred for psychedelic treatment, which was hugely helpful to many of them. Why is that? Because they were processing trauma in that way, right? I mean, we see many, many signs. That's just one of them.
What do you think psychedelics do, and why do they help us process our trauma? What's the role of them there as opposed to other substances, which can be inimical and negative?
Sure. The difference is when using anything that goes into us, so let's say a substance, the question would be, are we intoxicated by it? Right. You know, meaning, is there something toxic going on inside of us? It's unhealthy for us. And it, part of the toxicity is that it skews our judgment, right? I can still remember, you know, how many times a friend and I, who used to drink a bit excessively together many years ago, how many times did we decide we were going to write a novel together, right? How many times did we write the first five words and we were going to finish it the next day? Of course, that never, never, never happened. Why? Because in a state of intoxication, you know, we're somewhat euphoric and had all sorts of ideas that weren't rational ideas. You know, this is why you can't drive when you're drunk. We can't engage in judgment. We're intoxicated, right? Whereas psychedelic substances or psychedelic medicines used judiciously, and that's a hugely important point, right? They do not engender intoxication. In fact, quite the opposite. They engender truth and insight that people then can keep with themselves after the medicine has had its impact upon them. And there is, I believe, tremendous impact. The neuroscience of psychedelic substances tell us that the impact of it is more like what I would have thought would be science fiction. Like, it is so amazing the changes that are created in our brains and how those changes lead us away from the sort of human doing of everything bouncing around in our outer cortex of seeing, hearing, talking, planning, you know, all the things that are about survival. And those medicines put us in the deeper parts of our brain that are about existence and truth. So again, they can be dangerous if not respected and used in the right set and setting. But when that's the case, they help us heal, which is why from years, 100 years ago, all the way through the present, you know, we understand in Western society, we understand far, far longer than that in some non-Western societies, but we see that these substances can come at trauma. That's what they do. And if we come at trauma, we make ourselves healthier. So I think in many ways, the psychedelic revolution, the understanding now, is part and parcel of a revolution in understanding trauma. The two go hand in hand, each shedding light upon the other and each bringing hope and the reality, when people make certain decisions, the reality of healing.
I really like the way you just said that it's sort of like an untangling of trauma and substance abuse as well, because these things can get so knotty and messy. But for somebody who doesn't have access to psychedelics, or even, of course, psychedelics is almost like a shortcut where you're still going to be working through the same issues and processes, how do we begin to unpack trauma against substance abuse when they're so synergistic? Because you're engaging and using substances because of trauma, and yet the use of substances is causing trauma, perpetuating it, leading you not to deal with it, etc. Where do you begin, if that makes sense?
Well, I think it's a great question. And the answer is, where to begin is different for everyone. Right? I mean, everyone has their story, right? And if we understand the story, then we can understand how to proceed, which the converse, right? If we don't understand, we don't know where to proceed. So the process of inquiry, whether it's a person doing it themselves, doing it with a friend, doing it with a therapist, we have to understand ourselves so we know what thread to pull on. So for example, someone whose trauma and substance use are just so interwoven, right, that it's very, very hard to separate them, may need to start, for example, first with a detox. Right, someone who is drinking and they really can't not drink now, or if they stop drinking, they get very sick, and that can be dangerous, or people can have seizures, or so dangerous things can happen. It might be like, okay, we need to bring a full stop to the process and to the system, and it's medically indicated. Let's get this person detoxed from alcohol, see where it leaves us, right? Or maybe a person is intermittently abusing a substance, and we see there's a pattern of that person having tried very hard not to do that, and that is not worked, right? What happens most of the time in medicine is the person leaves to do the exact same thing again, right? Because here we're spending 15 minutes with patients not paying attention most of the time because the systems don't allow for it. But in a situation like that, maybe we start with the trauma. What is driving the use of the substance? If that person is using excessively but intermittently, why is that, right? Is that before or after exams, for example? Is that whenever there's a stimulus, whatever, something reminds them or triggers them of a certain thing that happened in the past? You know, they see war images on the television, or they hear about rape or sexual assault on the radio, right? What is going on in the person that's driving this forward? We have to understand. Many people have presented to me saying that they're alcoholics, right? Which would technically mean they're dependent upon alcohol. And that is not true. Right. They are not alcoholics. I mean, not any of the people I'm telling you about, the subset. They are abusing alcohol when they are triggered in a certain way. So then the empowerment there, the agency, the responsibility is understand yourself. Understand there's a difference between dependence on alcohol and reflexively, impulsively using alcohol as a way to avoid some thoughts or feelings inside. Let's understand what the thoughts and feelings are inside so that we help you not use alcohol, right? I mean, in so many ways, it is just common sense. And a lot of medical practice, our helping disciplines, psychology, clinical social work, I mean, a lot of what we do does not incorporate common sense into it. So if we have some knowledge and we use common sense, well, we will solve many problems, because would want to hear your story or another person's story. Let's talk about you and your story. So we decide what thread to pull on first in you. And we decide what we might do second or third. What are our backup plans? Maybe we do two things at once. Maybe we enlist other people. But if we understand, we're going to have a route of approach. And if we don't understand, we're not going to, which often leads to a random route of approach and leaves the person worse off than they were before.
I mean, thank you, Dr. Paul, first of all, for your time. And as we come towards the end of this podcast, I wanted to reframe the question of where to begin. As a concluding thought, what would you tell someone who's just watched this podcast, maybe doesn't have the money to pay for weekly therapy, which can, especially in America, be extremely expensive?
Yeah.
What can a person now go off and do as a first step? Let's say that it's not a substance abuse related issue. Imagine they're going through a very, very bad breakup and they've got extreme trauma from the toxicity of that breakup. Should they now go away and meditate? Should they now go away and exercise? What would you recommend as a first step?
Well, so the person has to be able to stop and think about themselves. So if you can be in a place of peace where you can avoid the thousands of thoughts that want to ping around in our heads, and the worries and the fears and whatever goes on inside of us. If you can find a quiet place inside of you and outside of you to reflect, you find that however it is that you find it. For one person, it may be meditation. Another person may need to go for a hike. A third person may find that after exercising. Someone else may watch something silly and mindless that just makes them laugh a little bit on television. Whatever it is, like, you've got to do what it is that gets you into a place where you can stop and think about yourself from that place of compassionate curiosity. Like, what is really going on in me? Why is this breakup going poorly? Is it going poorly because, you know, I've been through 7 bad breakups. They've all gone poorly in the same way. And the commonality is that I'm the person who's been there for all 7, right? Is it me? You know, is it a relationship just not going well, but I can't leave a relationship without having to make, you know, a huge conflict so I can say, oh, that's a bad person. Then that lets me leave. Maybe I'm doing that. Right? Maybe I'm choosing partners who aren't faithful, who aren't super interested in me because I don't feel great about myself. Whatever is going on, like, let me stop and think about myself and think about my behaviors today. Am I looking to go home and get in another argument with that person? Right? Could I handle that differently? Right? How could I take stock of what's going on inside of me and approach the breakup differently, have a different conversation, right? Maybe we're not bad people. We're just not the right people for one another. Okay. Maybe one of us is abusive. Let's look at that. If it's me, I really need to get myself some help. Or if I drive away good people, I need to get myself some help. But none of this is understood. A lot of what we do is we run through life as if, imagine you're running forward as fast as you can, and someone is running next to you who runs faster than you. And that person has their hand in the small of your back and is pushing you forward. So if you don't keep going, you're going to fall face flat forward. And what an awful feeling that is. And this is how life is for so many of us. Now, so many people are struggling to keep their heads above water, to make ends meet, you know, to have enough money in the bank or to be ready for that next exam. Or they're so fearful because someone around them is sick, or there's so much going on. And we can't live life that way. If we live life that way, we're not going to make good decisions. So we need to slow things down. We need to be able to stop and reflect so that hand isn't pushing us in the small of the back. And we're just trying to go forward. And maybe we run into a minefield, right? Or we run into a place that's even just less healthier than where we could have gone. So we have to slow down and find some peace in here to think about, what is going on in me? Why is it going on in me? What am I doing today? How could I make 1 or 2 even small different decisions today? How can I leverage those wins forward? And we can do this. The clinic here at Pacific Premier Group, where we are not an unhappy place. People come to us with trauma, and they often come to us with difficult issues, and they come to us feeling sad or upset. I mean, not always, but that's often how people approach mental health. It's how I felt when I went to get mental health treatment, but it does not have to stay that way. But it doesn't have to be that way. People leave a lot better than they came. And the world around us offers us this opportunity. If we have a better understanding, how do our brains work? How do our minds within our brains work? How does that affect back and forth with our bodies, right? How does it affect our decisions, our mood, anxiety, behavioral choices? There's so much to be gained. And through that insight, knowledge is power. I say, we are in the business of empowerment here. I am in the business of empowerment. My book is about empowerment. We can empower ourselves, and we can do it even if we don't have a whole lot of time. There are resources, my book just being one of them. We can help ourselves, but not if we're rushing forward in it with a sense of fear and desperation.
We'll leave the link to your book in the description below for all those listening. And you guys should definitely check it out. Dr. Paul Conti, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been extremely insightful.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you both for having me.
This has been The Loaf Podcast with Dr. Paul Conti. Out. Hey guys, hope you enjoyed our discussion with Dr. Paul Conti. We certainly did. If you'd like to see more content like this, be sure to drop a like and subscribe. Leave a comment down below with your thoughts. And if you'd like to check out a similar episode, you can click right here for our discussion with Dr. Joe Dispenza, similar-minded to Dr. Paul Conti. Thanks for watching, and see you next time.